Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The truth of the matter is that our system of psychological intervention, it never was created for Black people. And when you think about it, it's only been since 1964 that racial segregation was ended in the United States. And so when you think about those interventions, many of them were created, well before 1964. Many of them were created based on Eurocentric assumptions, ideas, and, to be honest, like for some of our clients, like especially the clients that are from underrepresented or marginalized or oppressed populations, using certain EBPs with them is like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole.
That was Jennifer Shepherd Payne on Psychologists Off the Clock.
We are three clinical psychologists here to bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas from psychology to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health.
I'm Dr. Debbie Sorensen, practicing in Mile High, Denver, Colorado, co-author of ACT Daily Journal and an upcoming book on ACT for Burnout.
I'm Dr. Yael Schoenbrunn, a Boston-based clinical psychologist, assistant professor at Brown University, and author of the book Work, Parent, Thrive.
And from coastal New England, I'm Dr. Jill Stoddard, author of Be Mighty, The Big Book of ACT Metaphors, and the upcoming Imposter No More.
We hope you take what you learn here to build a rich and meaningful life.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
We're proud to be sponsored by Praxis, the premier provider of continuing education training for mental health professionals.
Right now, Praxis is offering both virtual and in-person trainings. And for the virtual trainings, they have both live and on-demand courses.
Praxis is our go-to for evidence-based CE trainings, and they're especially known for their ACT trainings. Some of the best expert peer-reviewed ACT trainers offer courses with Praxis.
Check out their current offerings at praxisCET.com, or you can link to them through our website, offtheclockpsych.com. And you can get a discount on live training events if you use the code OFFTHECLOCK.
It's so important to me to feed my family nutritious food that's good for everyone's health, which is why I love giving my dogs Whole Life Pet treats and meal mixers. Tilly and Hazel go crazy for the Tuscan Bistro blend mixed with their kibble, and they are the most cooperative when they sniff out those beef, liver, chicken, or yogurt pumpkin treats. And it feels even better that I know it's good for them. Support Psychologists Off the Clock and use promo code POTC to get 25% off your first order with free shipping over $50 at wholelifepet.com/podcast. Whole Life Pet makes their products with the same quality and safety standards as people food, so you can feel good about spoiling your pets. If you're unsure about what to try, you can fill out their short questionnaire by clicking the red Start Today button on the homepage. It will ask you a few questions and make custom product recommendations for your pets. Visit wholelifepet.com/podcast and use promo code POTC to get 25% off your first order. Plus, you'll receive free shipping if your order is over $50. Again, that's wholelifepet.com/podcast with promo code POTC to get 25% off your first order.
If you're anything like me, you like to treat yourself. You know, you go get a pedicure and opt for that extra 10-minute foot massage with the green tea-infused scrub. Well, if you like to treat yourself to top options with everything in life, why settle when finding a doctor? It is your health after all. Enter ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book tens of thousands of top-tier doctors, all with verified patient reviews. So don't settle. Go for the best and find the right doctor for you. With ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. When I moved from California to Massachusetts, I had to get all new providers, and I used ZocDoc to book with several of them and found it super convenient and easy to use. So go to ZocDoc.com/POTC and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's zocdoc.com/POTC. zocdoc.com/POTC.
Hi, everyone. It's Debbie. I'm here with Yael today. We have an interview with Dr. Jennifer Shepherd Payne, who is talking to us about healing Black trauma caused by systemic racism using acceptance and commitment therapy. And I would like to just add a quick personal note about Jennifer, because I know Jennifer. We've worked together on some projects and gotten to know each other personally. And I just really admire the work that she's doing. And I think that she is a wonderful example to me of someone who is such a down-to-earth, humble, hardworking person who really embodies values in action, because I think she, as a Black woman in America, has been through a lot and has really channeled her pain and trauma and everything that she's experienced into doing something that's really values-driven. And I think her work is really important. So I was so grateful to her for coming on the podcast. And Yael, I know you listened to the episode too and had some thoughts about it.
I love the episode for so many reasons, including that Jennifer just seems like such a wonderful human being and that this topic is such an important one. There was kind of two things that I wanted to point out. So one is that, again, we're using psychology to address something that seems like a systems issue. And on the one hand, it seems counterintuitive and almost inappropriate to say that an individual approach should be used to tackle something that is clearly a problem that exists like everywhere outside of the individual. Like, racism is not an individual's fault. And yet we can use, and Jennifer talks about this, we can use psychology to empower people and actually to empower people to change systems. It's almost like a grassroots approach. So on the one hand, it seems wrong to think about how psychology fits into handling racial injustice. On the other hand, and as she talks about so eloquently, I think it's a really powerful approach.
Oh, I think that's such a good point. And I know that that's one that we've talked about on the podcast before and that we both have an interest in, which is how do the two work together, right? Can we help people heal from trauma, empower them, and also charge our own batteries? All of us, you know, Black people, white people, everyone, charge our own batteries so that we can, you know, confront the problems of the world and take meaningful action.
The second thing I wanted to mention that I just loved, because it was such an aha moment, and I'm maybe going to be embarrassed having shared this, but Jennifer talks about how in therapy, we often talk through metaphors. We sort of bring concepts to life and help people to really kind of connect with ideas through use of metaphors. And this is something that in the kind of treatment that you and Jill and I do, acceptance and commitment therapy, and that Jennifer Shepherd Payne does, that we talk about a lot. And what she talks about in her approach is using more culturally sensitive metaphors. And I will say, I haven't really thought about how important it is to be culturally sensitive in metaphors, because, you know, a metaphor that is really common in acceptance and commitment therapy may not be as relatable for somebody who's Jewish as it is for somebody who's Chinese or somebody who's African-American. And so to really be thoughtful about the way that we tailor ideas in therapy to the person that we're sitting with seems so important. And I will admit it, you know, when it comes to metaphors, I hadn't really thought about that before she made that point. And now it's something that's sort of like top of mind and such a wake-up call.
Well, I think that actually is part of what she's doing, what Jennifer's doing that's so important, is that she has personally found a lot of these practices really helpful in her own life, and they really resonated for her. And she's trying to bring it into this world of racial trauma where, you know, people need support, they need empowerment, they need healing, they need action. Sometimes these concepts aren't reaching people who could benefit from them. And so I really appreciate her work on, you know, getting this out there and the work that she's doing to help train people in ACT for racial trauma and to reach people who can benefit from it.
Yeah, it was such a powerful moment when she was talking about getting training in this approach and acceptance and commitment therapy and being, you know, the only person of color in the room. And I do think, you know, it sort of begs the question of, is acceptance and commitment therapy useful for everybody? And she says, no, it is. It's just not reaching people. So what we need to do is tailor it and also extend it in ways that are, you know, more effective. I was just thinking that, like, what she's doing is taking concepts that have been built for white people in a pretty narrow way that are good, solid concepts and really thoughtful concepts and practices. And she's finding that they're useful outside of white populations, outside of these narrowly defined populations for which they were developed. And she's tailoring them to be even more helpful and then helping to bring them to the people who actually can benefit. And I think, you know, from academic science, you can develop something and then, you know, it takes other people to courier it out into the world and to make sure that it reaches people at the heart level. And that's the work that she's doing. And I just think it's so inspirational.
My hope is that listeners will find this episode really helpful. I think she's specifically, you know, as a Black woman herself, she specifically is writing about the experience of Black trauma. And I think it's also very important for white people to take a listen as well, because I think she offers a perspective that we need to hear. And so I hope it will really be something that everyone gets something out of this episode. And please share this episode with others who might be interested in learning more about racial trauma. I'm delighted to have on our podcast today my friend and colleague, Dr. Jennifer Shepherd Payne. Dr. Payne is a research scientist and clinician for the Kennedy Krieger Institute in the Center for Child and Family Traumatic Stress and the Center for the Neuroscience of Social Injustice. She is also an assistant professor in the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine with a primary appointment within the Department of Psychiatry, Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Dr. Payne received her doctorate from the UCLA School of Public Affairs and is a licensed clinical social worker. Her research interests include developing culturally tailored community-based depression and trauma interventions and addressing minority mental health disparities. Additionally, she is a board member of MEND, an international organization of clinicians of color who are trauma-trained to help oppressed communities. For several years, Dr. Payne has been working on culturally tailoring acceptance and commitment therapy for African-American communities experiencing racial trauma. She developed a culturally tailored ACT intervention, and she's the author of her brand new book, Out of the Fire, Healing Black Trauma Caused by Systemic Racism Using Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas from that book today. Jennifer, thanks so much for being here. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's our pleasure. Thanks for being here. I think that, you know, as I read through your book and just know the work that you've been doing, mostly through MEND and some of the other work that you've been doing the last few years, I know that this is just, your voice is really important, I think, in our work that we do. And I'm so grateful to have you here to share some of your ideas, because I think that, you know, they need to be shared far and wide.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that. I feel like it's just a part of my heart. So I feel like it's just something that I just move forward with. So I appreciate it.
Well, that's actually kind of where I want to start off our conversation today, because one of the things that I found the most powerful in your book, Jennifer, is, you know, you share examples, clinical examples, you have some great metaphors, and you share some personal stories. It really brought the book to life, and I think felt so powerful to read. And so I was just wondering if you could start us off by sharing a little bit about your own personal story behind how and why you are doing this work that you're so passionate about, and you wrote this particular book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do have to say that my goal is to live a life of authenticity and transparency. And I think that was also one of the goals, to relay that in the book in some way. It's vulnerable, but at the same time, I'm finding that even with the clients that I work with, which I work at the Center for Child and Family Traumatic Stress. And I do see a small cadre of clients there. All of them have trauma issues. And I find that, you know, just like selective disclosure, like very intentional disclosure really helps for people, you know, that are going through trauma. But so in terms of your question about the how and the why, so I think about the word serendipity, serendipity, where, you know, you get something valuable that you didn't even ask for, or you didn't seek it out. I think that kind of defines how the book got written. And so, like, if I think about back in spring of 2020, when, you know, there was so much happening in the world, there, of course, the George Floyd murder was taking place in March, and we were right in the throes of COVID-19. During that time, I received an email. And to be honest, I don't even know who the person was that I got the email from. It was somebody that was asking if I knew of any individuals who were writing books about the Black experience or about social injustice issues. I don't know how the person got my email. I don't know how they knew about me. And to this day, I don't even know who sent the email, because I don't have access to that email address anymore. I got it from a prior faculty position that I was at. So, but one thing I do remember is I remember writing to the editor that was referred to me. And I said, you know, I don't know the other people, but I know that I'm working on some like culturally tailoring act right now. And so maybe there's a possibility that I could write on that. And that kind of started a chain of events where I went and submitted the proposal to New Harbinger. And then we moved on to write the book. And so that's the how of the book. But the why of the book is a little more complicated. Because when I think about the why could be traced back to childhood, actually. I mean, the why has to do with, you know, just how I was raised. And I was actually raised in a pretty, very stable environment, two-parent household, middle class. But I had friends that lived in neighborhoods very close to me. I had, colleagues that, you know, were in school with me, elementary school or junior high or high school, and they were going through a lot. Like, they were going through so many, like, financial situations, structural inequities, or family problems. And so I can think about, even back then when I was, like, a child, that I had, like, this heart for underrepresented populations, heart for, you know, some of the pain that you know, some of the people around me was going through. And then when I grew up, I started moving towards these types of careers and education, such as social work, with the goal to help alleviate that distress, or at least address the pain in some kind of way. And so, you know, the why of the book is, you know, kind of happened a lot earlier in my life, but I just didn't know how it was going to manifest until the book came.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think that just reading more about your story and what you shared today, it just seems like that is absolutely, you know, we'll talk about values in this conversation, and that's a big part of ACT and a big part of your book. Yeah. And it just absolutely seems like 100% mission driven from the heart. And I know that George Floyd's murder and the other events that happened around that time, I mean, I think that just really had such a personal impact that, you know, really was another driver for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that was a driver for, and I know you mentioned MEND, and I know you're a part of MEND as well. And so MENDMINDS.org, that's a nonprofit organization where clinicians of color come together to learn different trauma treatments. And in turn, what they do is they ask that we give a couple of pro bono services a year to those that need it in our communities. And the whole reason how that came about, MEND, the whole reason how this book came about, all of those kind of stemmed really from that George Floyd murder. And I talk about that in the book, you know, how that affected me and how I think that was the only time in my life that I have ever been angry for a whole week. And I am a spiritual person, so it troubled me, you know, to have that kind of anger when I saw that video. But I'm sure that same anger is the same anger that many other people have felt, and that it drove a lot of the different things that are going on in regards to social injustice right now. But definitely. Right.
Which probably wasn't the first time you felt that anger about similar issues, but it sounds like that particular week, it just really, you know, kind of really was so strong and was an indicator of the level of just injustice. Like, you know, I've had enough of this.
Right. And I think that's the way that each of us had to find out, how can we deal with this anger? And for me, writing was a way of dealing with it. So I wrote a poem, and I'm sure, I know you're familiar with the poem.
Yeah, you've shared it on the podcast before. We'll link to that on the show notes for today. Yeah.
Yeah. So that poem is also like in the beginning of the book. And the poem really is just speaking to, you know, exactly what I felt at that time. I felt like I needed to write. And so this writing of this book has actually been cathartic for me. There's been several, like, very serious things that have gone on over the course of that year or 2 years that I was writing the book. And when I say going on, not just in the world, but also in terms of my own family, my husband passed away during this time. There was a number of things that took place, and it was cathartic to write the book.
Yeah. Yeah, a hopeful action during a challenging time. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So one of the things that you write about in the book is, of course, racial trauma. Your book is focused on Act for Healing Black Trauma. And you write about the experience of being Black in America and also some of the ways in which our current mental health systems fall short for Black people and aren't up to the challenge of this. And I think that my personal opinion is that we as a mental health field need to take a serious look at that. And I know that this is a really big topic, probably could be its own episode. But I was just wondering if you could share some thoughts on that mental health disparity, but more than that, just like the ways in which we're not able to meet this really important problem.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, so the system that we use, you know, whether you call it the psychological system or the mental health system that we use in America, I mean, it wasn't created in a vacuum. I mean, we think that it just kind of is a standalone, but it actually was created in a context that's influenced by the time and the societal atmosphere in which it was birthed. And so, I mean, the truth of the matter is that our system of psychological intervention, it never was created for Black people. You know, and when you think about it, it's only been since 1964, 58 years ago, and actually like not since my birth, because I was born in 1964, it was only since then that racial segregation was ended in the United States. So 58 years, that's not much time. And so when you think about those interventions, many of them were created, well before 1964. Many of them were created based on Eurocentric assumptions, ideas. And, you know, to be honest, like for some of our clients, like especially the clients that are from underrepresented or marginalized or oppressed populations, using certain EBPs with them is like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of them has to do with you know, most of our EBPs are geared towards an identified patient. Most of them are individualistic in nature. Most of them like focus on that person that's right in front of you, like looking just at their feelings, their behaviors. But there's many clients that come into therapy that are having pain issues that are not just due to individual issues. There's some clients that are coming into therapy with pain because of systemic issues that are taking place in their life, things that they have no control over or they have little control over. And EBPs really don't address that. In fact, sometimes it's almost like blaming the victim. If we look at, you know, oh, well, let's look at your individual problems. Let's look at, you know, what's going on with you individually, when in reality, there's other things that are causing the pain. Another problem with, you know, our system as it is now is, you know, I mean, we know that it's a business, right? So a lot of people, like we have to bill. And so in order to, you know, to bill, you know, we need to bill in order to do the therapy with the client. In order to do that, we have to establish medical necessity. And so that means, like, for the most part, that a person has to have a clear reason for coming into treatment or a problem, you know, per se. And so that leads to, like, looking at the ICD-9 codes, which, you know, basically looking at the diagnostic manual for mental disorders or the DSM, looking at them in order to pick a diagnosis, put it on the on the line so that we can charge to actually see the client. But there's some clients out there that are just having a normal response to an abnormal environment, or a normal response to a toxic environment. And so that really means that anybody would have a problem if they were in that same situation. I have a client right now, and I'm not disclosing, you know, much about that client, but that client has so many systemic issues going on at once in their life. If I was, you know, him or her, I would have a problem in that same situation. So there's no diagnosis that you can really attach to that. And so, you know, but a lot of times that's how we look at it in terms of mental health treatment. And then, you know, one of the other things that's problematic is the fact that, you know, a lot of our interventions are approved based on randomized controlled trials. And there's nothing wrong necessarily with randomized controlled trials. But the problem for me is that they use primary homogeneous populations when they're doing these randomized controlled trials. And that's what you have to do just by default, is that you need to test it on a homogeneous population. But the homogeneous population ends up being primarily white, primarily English speaking, primarily heterosexual populations. So how do we, you know, how do we really know that these interventions are hitting the mark or the target for the people that we serve?
Yeah, I think you make a really important point here, which is that it's philosophically from, you know, its historic origins has never been, it's always been biased. It's always been a certain point of view that is definitely not going to fit all people, all situations, and that tendency to pin a diagnosis on someone and say, oh, this is a problem we need to fix within you, when it so clearly is systemic. And then you think about the individual person going to a therapist, and there's, you know, a majority of therapists are white and may not be familiar with that experience, definitely not on a personal level, but may have not even learned anything and may have some, I mean, obviously we all have some racial biases or some areas where we may act in a way that's not going to feel accepting or welcoming or understanding of the person's experience. And I don't know if you have thoughts on that, on what it's like, you know, as a Black person yourself to see that happen with individual clients who want mental health treatment and can't find a good fit, which is on, you know, again, that's on the field.
Right. Right. Well, so I actually just did a presentation last week on this topic. Well, it was more geared towards clinicians of color and just the fact that they themselves have been, you know, overburdened by this, just this influx of the need for mental health care the past 2 or 3 years. And how can they deal with that? How can they create self-care for themselves? But in reality, less than 5% of the mental health workforce is Black. And so that does mean that other people need to hopefully have some cultural sensitivity to be able to work with that population. And there's a lot of demand for clinicians of color at this time. And it's just for the same reason that you just mentioned. I just heard just recently, I think there were 2 or 3 different clients that said it in similar ways. But basically what they said was, I really would love to see someone who I don't have to tell my whole story to, or have to explain what racial trauma feels like to them, you know, or have to explain myself to them. And so, yeah, that is a difficult situation.
Yeah. Well, and we as a field need to do better to fix what's happened in the past moving forward. And I know it's not a simple, quick fix, but it's so important. Yeah. Well, in the book, one of the things I was really interested in were your thoughts on resilience. And I think often, you know, we look at resilience as a really, you know, a positive thing, a really good trait. It's like, oh yeah, life can be hard and adversity happens and we need to, you know, try to do our best to adapt and to be resilient. But I thought it was really powerful what you wrote, like, why do we always have to be resilient? That usually Black families and Black individuals are expected to adapt to adversity. And at some point it's exhausting and unfair, you know? So can you share your thoughts on resilience and like your own personal experience around that?
Sure, sure. Yeah, so when I first started my doctoral program at UCLA, that first year that we had, you know, a number of different courses that we had to take, and I think one of them was a course on epistemology, I think. And in that course, at the end, you were able to choose a topic to research. And I chose resilience because at that time, I thought that, you know, it was a positive word. And I still, you know, I still understand the rationale behind resilience. But, you know, when you think about resilience, being resilient is defined as being capable of withstanding shock or without permanent rupture, without bending too much. It's like a person that's able to recover from or to adjust easily to misfortune or change. And so over time, there's been lots of studies out there that show that Blacks are resilient. And I think that's fine. But, you know, I remember reading something from Dr. Leslie Anderson. She asked a great question. She asked, why are Black families expected to continuously have to adapt to adverse environments? And, you know, I mean, in a way, when you think about it, in the United States, we're kind of put in a position to have to demonstrate perseverance, to demonstrate perseverance amid chronic adversity. So instead of dealing with the systematic oppression, we are supposed to kick back and model resilience. And I agree. I mean, when you said, you know, you thought like it seems unfair. Yes, it does seem unfair to, like, why do we always have to be the strong ones? Why are those systems continuing to be the way they are in the first place? And if there were other populations that had to like bump their heads against the same wall over and over, instead of saying, "Oh, well, you're really doing a good job of bumping your head against that wall and just getting bouncing back up and not falling. You're doing a good job. But what about the wall? Is it possible to do something about the wall itself?" I feel like, you know, resilience, it feels like a double-edged sword to me because yes, we're resilient. Thank God we're resilient, because otherwise if we weren't resilient, then what would it be? You know, we wouldn't continue to be. But there's a lot of people that are out there that the way their resilience looks is they're surviving. They're not thriving. And so I talk to a lot of my clients about how can you get to a place of thriving? Because, I mean, yes, you know, we are able to survive. We have the fortitude to survive, but we deserve at some point to thrive.
Yeah. I'll read a quote from your book that I made a note of. You said, "We as a nation bear responsibility to do more than encourage resilience." And I think that's about moving that wall. It's right. Like, let's move the wall out of the way. And then we don't have to focus so much on resilience as the solution to this.
Exactly.
Let's look at the problem itself and see what we can do and how that could be so much better.
It's Patricia Karpus, host of Untangle, the award-winning podcast that covers topics like optimizing brain health, finding your purpose, how to sleep better, harnessing the power of anxiety, successfully changing habits, finding more happiness and joy, and overall, all the many ways to live your best life. If you enjoy hearing from thought leaders, neuroscientists, psychologists, nutritionists, business leaders, and more, join us wherever you listen to podcasts.
So let's move a little bit more into the ACT part of your work. You were drawn to ACT as an approach, at least in part, because it's non-pathologizing and because of the stance that it takes on human pain. You use the metaphor of pain being like the fire, you know? Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about why you think ACT appealed to you as, you know, enough to write a book on it, and how it has potential to be helpful to African Americans who have experienced racial trauma?
Sure. Yeah. So the way that I learned about ACT is I actually learned about it, I mean, it was less than 10 years ago. It was like a few years ago. And I learned about it. I don't think it's a happenstance way, but basically what happened is I was teaching a class on intervention and evaluation for master level social work students at a university. And it was the class that I, you know, kind of I put together in terms of which evidence-based interventions we would talk about from week to week. And so there was a particular week of mindfulness-based interventions. And I invited a good friend and colleague of mine, a fellow professor at the university, Dr. Regina Trama. I asked her to come and be a guest speaker in my class. And so she did. You know, she talked about the different interventions that are mindfulness-based. She talked about the, the third wave interventions, such as, you know, mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy. And then she mentioned ACT, which I had not heard of until she presented it to the class. And, you know, based upon what she was saying about it, and she said a little bit about it, I was interested. So I went and I took a class. It was a two or three day class on acceptance and commitment therapy. And I was one of the very few, if not the only, Black person in the room. But I absolutely loved it. And it kind of hit me immediately. I think that all of the interventions, and I think it's interesting because, I've taught a number of different interventions. That was never really, I'm not saying committed, but I mean, I'm like, okay, whatever, CBT, yeah, this is what it's like, but I really just, I felt something different with acceptance and commitment therapy, and I think it does have to do with, the fact that, it's non-pathologizing, that it has a lack of a lean towards diagnosing individuals, that you don't have to have a diagnosis to use it, that anybody can use it. In fact, I use it in my own life. I'm sure, and I know you do, in your daily life. So I think that it just was like, human pain was ubiquitous, and that was very calming. That was very reassuring. Pain is something that all of us go through. And so dealing with that or facing that, that's beautiful. So I think that's one of the things that really drew me to it. But then I got, to be honest, I got a little bit irritated because I started, going to more trainings, and there's still, I was one of the only, I would say, raisins in the milk. I was pretty much, one of the only Black people in the room over and over. And I was like, what, why, how come we, how come people of color don't know about this training? How come we don't know as much about this training as we could or should? And I did a training once. I did a training in California, and it really was primarily people of color in the room. There were a couple of people that were not people of color, but I said, raise your hand if you've heard of acceptance commitment therapy. Nobody raised their hand except for about two or three people. And out of those two or three people, I think at least one of them was not a person of color. And so I was a little confused about that. And so because of that, I think that also kind of helped me to move forward on, let me get the word out a little bit more to people of color. And also let me look at ACT to see how it might be even better, even more relevant for the Black community.
So it seems like you saw a potential for it. You saw it personally in your own life and saw how it could be applied, but it was maybe just being delivered in a way that it wasn't reaching people who could potentially benefit from some of these concepts. And I think in your book, you go through the core processes of ACT and tie it to the Black experience in America and racial trauma. And, for instance, even using metaphors that I think would be more culturally relatable, like your values chapter is living life like it's golden, and acceptance is what it is, and the freedom to let go. And I think you use examples throughout your book too that you might not see in the typical kind of white person written ACT book that wouldn't maybe be quite as relatable for this specific population and this specific issue.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I felt like, I get other people also, I think, say this, but metaphors are very powerful, but they have to be relevant as well. And so for instance, I do remember very clearly the quicksand metaphor, the metaphor of just going in quicksand. There's nothing wrong with that metaphor, but I personally have never experienced seeing quicksand. I've never been anywhere that you know, Quixam would exist. I've seen it on television. I can imagine it in my mind, but it's just not really as relevant as something else might be. Yeah. And so I think like the more relevant the metaphor, the more powerful it can be for the individual.
One of the metaphors that you wrote about that I have an interest in burnout. I'm writing a book on burnout. And so I was really drawn to this one was about, you write about racial battle fatigue as a metaphor for pain and values sort of going hand in hand, which is an important ACT concept. Could you, as just an example, could you share that idea? And also, I think it's actually relevant to what you were talking about earlier with why you were drawn to doing this particular work.
So the problem with you know, us, and when I say us, I say us as African Americans, is that we have to have some level of guard up because the systems are not just completely safe, period. They're just not. So I'll say, you know, I have a grandson, and you know, when these different things happen in the media, when they happen in the news, when people are shot or killed because of their race, I mean, it affects all of us. Like, it affects all of us in the sense that we don't necessarily feel safe. We have to teach our children how to act in an environment that may not always be safe. And so because of that, it's not necessarily having a chip on our shoulders, but we have a burden on our shoulders most of the time. It's almost like, you know, if you have somebody who has PTSD and that they always have to be on guard, and you tell them, no, you can put your guard down, but that's not necessarily true. Is that you can, you know, you can't always put your guard down. Because the thing is that there may always be, unfortunately, it may always be either a microaggression that takes place or a systemic issue that might happen at work, you know, where, or you may get stepped over for a job that, you know, that maybe you should have gotten, and it, you know, so there's always going to be these the potential for either physical harm or emotional harm. There's always that potential that's there until the systems are corrected. It's always there. So
yeah, it's like versus a one-time traumatic event where you could almost say, oh, that's so rare, you know, let's work on getting past that because it's not going to happen again. But this exactly. is more chronic and more, you know, it's chronic. Not, yeah.
It's chronic. So 400 years, you know, of, you know, racial issues in America for African Americans. And so it's not going to stop like anytime soon. So in other words, many of us, if not all of us, you know, we carry something like in regards to our safety, slightly a guard, but the metaphor about boxing 24/7 really has to do with allowing us to give ourselves permission to let go of our guard at certain times. So, because we don't have to be on guard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If we do that day in, day out, then we're going to burn out. You know, it's just like chronic stress. But there are ways for us to create safe spaces for ourselves where we can let go of our guard during those times. So like there's some people that they're so used to being on guard that they're on guard at home. They're on guard, you know, all the time. And, you know, and so is there a way to let go of some of that? You know, not, I mean, I'm not asking them to let go of all of it. I think that's a different way of speaking than you would speak to just a client in general, where you know, you might just encourage them to let go of all of their stress. So that's just an example.
Yeah, that's a great example. So, and another thing you had mentioned earlier about having to be strong, right, and resilience. And I think within the ACT model, we talk a lot about being aware of narratives and self-stories that aren't so helpful. And you give an example that I think is another really powerful one about the strong Black woman, strong Black man narrative, which is, you know, out there in our, here in the United States, at least, as a narrative, as an identity. And yeah, again, kind of like the resilience thing, it's one that seems empowering, but sometimes actually has a less helpful side. And so can you talk a little bit about those examples of, you know, the strong Black woman, strong Black man narrative?
Yeah, sure. So there's a metaphor that's or exercise rather in the book that has to do with, you know, the strong Black person. And I can't speak for everyone, you know, all Black people. That's not my goal to speak for all of us. However, I know in my own upbringing, like I told you, I was brought up in a very stable environment. And even being in a stable environment, I heard cultural statements, you know, as I was growing up. And one of those has to do with being a strong Black woman and how we need to stay strong, and that we will often need to take twice as much as anyone else in order to get the same result. And I've experienced that to a certain degree, you know, whether it's in education or in your career or in other areas, that there are times when it does feel that way, that you have to be, you know, the strong Black woman or the strong Black man. There's like lots of cultural idioms that come up that, you know, for Black men, I mean, and I think that it's both cultural and it has to do with gender-based like roles or stereotypes. But you have to man up. You have to make sure that, you know, you're hard. You can't be, you know, you can't ever really you know, show too much emotion except for maybe anger, but not too many other emotions. Definitely not depression in the way that classic depression is shown. And for me, you know, yeah, that strong Black woman, it runs deep. It's like, you know, you need to be a strong Black woman, even, you know, if somebody else is not, you know, they don't have to be, you know, girl, I don't have time for, I don't have time for no depression. You know, I have to keep it moving. I have to keep it real. And so whether all of these systemic things are going on in your life, that's not a reason for you to not be strong. You still need to be strong. And so the metaphor really has to do with taking a look at how much you're actually holding. And I'm not going to go into detail about the metaphor here, but basically the metaphor allows you to look at all of the weight that you're carrying. And then you can look at it and then look and then kind of almost go meta, you know, like self as context. You can go meta and look at yourself holding all of that weight and have some compassion for yourself, because anybody that had that much weight that you have, you know, should have more compassion than you're showing yourself. And so there's a, and this is not in the book, but like a lot of times when I talk about this to other African Americans, I talk about there's a movie called Waiting to Exhale. It's a, you know, older movie, but allowing us to have permission to exhale, allowing us to have permission to stop holding that breath, because we hold that breath. We hold the breath and we keep it and we just like walk with it. But there's a possibility to be able to not necessarily hold their breath. You do not have to be strong all the time.
Yeah, I took a note when I was reading permission to exhale and permission to be human.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're familiar with this, Jennifer, but there's a new book by Tricia Hersey that just came out. She has the nap ministry, and she has this new book out called Rest as Resistance, as like a social justice movement, is to say, you know, I'm putting down the weight of the world and taking a nap, you know. And to me, what that's about when you're describing this, just this heavy load and permission to be human, is having some flexibility around that. Like, you know, okay, you're strong in one moment, you know, quote strong, I'm using air quotes here, quote strong in 1 minute, and you're taking a nap the next minute, you're exhaling.
Yes.
Versus kind of feeling like no matter what, I can't exhale. I can't let my guard down like that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And that's where those narratives, it's like, it's really important to take a look at them, because when we don't have that flexibility built in, it can be, it can really limit things.
Right. Yeah. And I think I think this is a wonderful way for African Americans to start thinking about how can we be flexible? You know, what things are we able to let go of, and what things do we have to hold on to?
Well, there are, you know, again, several other ACT processes throughout your book, and metaphors and exercises and examples that, again, I think are really powerful. I want to end with a couple more questions, though, more along the lines of values and actions. And one thing I think that you really emphasize in your book is a little different, again, than the kind of white Western typical model of psychology, because you really emphasize collective Black values, the more communal values and the communal nature of values. And I think that, you know, often that's unemphasized in, you know, in our world that we are in with ACT and mental health. And so I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit about why you emphasize that in your book, the communal and collective values, and also maybe give a few examples, because you give a lot of examples.
Oh, sure.
In the book. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So kind of like what I talked about a little bit earlier, where I was talking about the fact that these interventions that we use are kind of a square peg in a round hole situation to a certain degree. I think one thing that would make it fit better definitely has to do with looking at the difference between when somebody is having an individual problem and when they're having a systemic problem. Because if they're having an individual problem, then that would take certain actions. But if they're having a systemic problem, then there probably would be a need for different actions. So that's the reason why I kind of broke up values and broke up committed action into two separate parts. So yes, there's individual values that we can look at. I mean, you know, we know the various individual values. I mean, love or acceptance or education or, you know, whatever. But so there's a lot of like individual values that we can have. But I think that it's really important for not only but for Black people not only to establish but to move forward on communal actions. And when I say communal action, that means whatever your community is, or if you don't have a community, which is like really kind of vital, you need social supports in order to reach these systemic issues. You can't do this by yourself. You can't do it as an island. So if you don't have social support, then how can we create social support for you? But So that's the reason why pulling out a fire, you know, or POOF, the POOF model is a group model. It's not an individual model.
Can I just jump in real quick to because I was just reading a critique recently that within, you know, some more white therapy models, there's like more emphasis on setting boundaries and almost like, oh, well, that person's toxic, cut them out of your life forever. And I mean, I know that there are some people that are like abusive and like narcissistic abuse and that kind of thing. So I get that. But the commentary that I was reading was about like, yeah, that doesn't fly for a lot of people in a lot of communities and in certain cultures. It's like, that's not, that model is not going to resonate or work. And I mean, I personally, you know, as a white person, I still think that goes too far sometimes. Like, you know, community and social support is important for everyone, but I just haven't thought about it that way. Like, yeah, that's not going to land well for a lot of people.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, and I agree with you. I think that when I'm talking about social supports, I am primarily talking about positive social support.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not, you know, I mean, yeah, you know, it is draining to have someone who's toxic in your environment. But it's not as simple as cut them off. You know, it's not that simple either. So, but the point is, I guess there are a lot of people that are, kind of living in silos, and they, are struggling really, you know, desperately. And then maybe they come to therapy and the group therapy, the format where you have 10 people in the group and going through these, like, these parts of the Hexaflex, for a few weeks together. And then really like honing in on, if you don't have a community, this is your new community. So this group of people, you know, like they begin to actually form like their own relationships amongst themselves. So it becomes more like, instead of me being a therapist, I'm more of a facilitator, and then they come together. So coming together is important. Like finding out what values does your community hold, in the sense that, you know, where, like, what values are we moving forward, or we want to move forward as a community, like whether it's our individual communities, or whether it's our families, or whether it's our, you know, our churches, our synagogues, I mean, whatever, however we want to define our group, our tribe, that's how we define it. But how does the tribe look at moving forward? What's most important to them? Is it freedom? Is it liberty? Is it determination? Is it, you know, what are those things that, like, as a group we can move forward on? Because the group things have to do with systemic change. You can't change a system by yourself. And so communal committed action is something that people together can do. And you don't have to reinvent a wheel. You don't have to say, okay, well, my community is not really helpful. You know, I'm not able to connect with them. Then connect with an organization or an agency that's already out there doing the things that matter to you. It could be on a national level. It could be, you know, it doesn't have to like be just as closed as the individuals that are right around you. But even like if you take one step towards systemic change, then that makes you feel fulfilled.
Yeah, it's meaningful. It's both. I think that's an inspiring note to end on, because I think it's both helpful to you because it connects you to your values and you're taking action toward your values, which is really meaningful and hopeful and important. And also part of what you're doing is to help address this problem at the level that really matters, right? And Jennifer, I think this is the perfect note to end on, actually.
Okay.
Because yeah. I think that you have been a living demonstration of that in, you know, as you're describing the work that you've done over the last few years. And I know it's been, you know, challenging in a lot of ways for you because you've had, meanwhile, you know, your own life stressors going on. But to see some examples of putting that into action. And I know there are, one of the things that you have in your book are a number of kind of ideas and resources for people for some of the ways, some more specific ways in which they can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think we've done that. I mean, you know, you have joined MEND and a number of us have joined MEND and just decided that, you know what, this is a value to us. And so we've decided to partner together towards, you know, same thing, systemic change is, you know, I think that's when it becomes powerful, when a community comes together to try to make a difference about something.
Absolutely. Our mutual friend, Corinne, who also was on that previous episode back a ways back, and she talks about the potluck and each person finding their piece that they can bring to the potluck, whatever piece that may be for you. Yeah,
exactly.
So Jennifer, on that note, we'll wrap up. And again, I'll remind people, you can find the book Out of the Fire, Healing Black Trauma Caused by Systemic Racism Using Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. If you are interested in joining MEND for racial trauma, either as a clinician of color or as an ally and supporter of MEND, we'll link to that, MEND Mind. How can people find you online, Jennifer? Do you have any ways that people can connect with you online?
Sure. Feel free to go to my website. It's www.poof-pullingoutoffire.com.
That's what POOF stands for, pulling out of fire.
Yes.
Yes, which is one of the metaphors in the book about, you know, kind of a different way to approach the pain. Yeah. Well, Jennifer, I appreciate your book. I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And thank you again so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I loved being here. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jennifer. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, Psychologists Off the Clock listeners, I'm going to guess that if you are listening to this episode, that you love to geek out about books in psychology.
So if you are a fellow book nerd like Yael and I, and all of the people around you are tired of you talking about books, then you can join us once a month to really take a deep dive into the books that we're going to be reading together.
So if you want to join us, all you have to do is send an email with the subject heading RSVP to offtheclockpsych@gmail.com, and we'll send you information for upcoming meetings of the book club. We hope to see you there.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. If you enjoy our podcast, you can help us out by leaving a review or contributing on Patreon.
You can get more psychology tips by subscribing to our newsletter, and you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Connect with us on social media by going to our website at offtheclockpsych.com/merch.
We'd like to thank our strategic consultant, Michael Harold, our dissemination coordinator, Katie Rothfelder, and our editorial coordinator, Melissa Miller.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment. If you're having a mental health emergency, dial 911. If you're looking for mental health treatment, please visit the resources page of our website, offtheclockpsych.com.